Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to today's special Talking Freight, Talking Tiger seminar on Tiger II discretionary grants and Tiger II TIFIA payments. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing the audio over your computer as well. Today we'll have several presenters and others joining to answer questions. Once I get through this, I'm going to turn it over to Jacob Falk from the policy advisor. He's policy advisor to the Office of the Secretary. We also have Beth Osborne, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy, Sherry Ricklin, FTA Deputy Associate Administrator, Office of Planning and Environment, Bob Bouchard, MARAD Director, Office of Infrastructure Development and Congestion Mitigation, Ron Hines, FRA Director, Office of Policy, Regina McElroy, FHWA Director, Office of Innovative Program Delivery, Mark Sullivan, Senior Advisor, Office of Innovative Program Delivery, Dwayne Callender, TIFIA Joint Program Office Team Leader, Darren Timothy, FHWA Office of Innovative Program Delivery Program Development Team Leader, Harlan Miller, FHWA Office of Planning, Oversight and Stewardship Team Leader, Marlis Osterhuis, Office of Project Development and Environmental Review, and Tony First, FHWA Director of Freight Management and Operations. I'm now going to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last about 90 minutes. We'll get through the presentation first and then get to question and answer at the end. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering the questions during the presentation, but once I start off the Q&A session, we'll start with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all the questions that have been typed in, for those of you on the phone line, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask questions over the phone. For those of you who are listening to the audio over the computer, you will only have the option of typing in your questions. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the Freight Planning Listserv, or we can get you the information from the presenters to send it to them directly. Again, I'd like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion, as well as the presentation, will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next few weeks. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend today to access the recording. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic is Tiger II discretionary grants and Tiger II TIFIA payments. And as a reminder, if you have questions during the presentations, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered following the presentation. So I'm now going to turn it over to Jacob Falk, Policy Advisor for the Office of the Secretary. And I'll bring up the presentation in 1 minute. Okay.
Great, so thank you very much. Thank you all for participating in this webinar on the Tiger II Discretionary Grant Program. We're going to start with going through sort of some program overview, some background information. We'll move into some of the specifics, and we're going to, as we get through the presentation, we're going to finish up with some qualities and strategies of competitive applications, sort of tips, guidance for really how to make an application very strong. So we'll get started with the first slide, the program overview. The original Tiger program, Tiger One, was a Recovery Act program, so it included certain Recovery Act requirements. This program, Tiger Two, is $600 million, which was provided through the fiscal year 2010 Appropriations Act, so it's no longer technically a Recovery Act program, but the program is very, very similar to the original Tiger program, and we're treating it similarly. And the underlying principle of looking for projects that have a significant impact on the nation, a metropolitan area, or a region remains the same in Tiger II. As with Tiger One, there's opportunity. The primary opportunity is for capital grants for surface transportation projects, but we do also have funding for TIFIA, and as well as this time, something different from the first round, we have funding for planning grants. The program, another aspect of the program that is similar from the first round is that in choosing projects, we're not looking only for projects that have a significant impact, but we're also required by statute to provide for an equitable geographic distribution. We're required to balance the needs of urban and rural areas. And this time as well, we have a requirement to invest in a variety of transportation modes. So the next slide is the Federal Register notice. We published a interim notice, and because this was a new program, we asked for comments over a two-week period. We got back comments, and the final notice of funding availability was available in the Federal Register this past Friday and is now published in hard copy in today's Federal Register. So this is the operative notice of funding availability, is what should be looked at. It's very similar in many respects to the Tiger One, and the final notice is also, we made a handful of changes from between the interim notice published in April to the final notice, but the final notice does have some changes. You should definitely take a look and see what those changes are, and we'll be talking about a few of them throughout this presentation.
I'll go ahead and address the planning side. We put in the interim notice a desire to take comments on the possibility of collaborating with HUD and their community challenge planning grants, and those planning grants were meant for local planning efforts like station area planning or TOD planning or setting up land banking programs or updating building codes and zoning codes, which obviously are things that go along the sides of transportation projects, and when done right can enhance a transportation project's chance for success. We are continuing to review the comments that we have received and are working with HUD on the potential of doing a joint notice of funding availability, and we anticipate having something in the Federal Register in the next week or two.
All right, so moving along, one thing that hasn't changed from Tiger 1 to Tiger 2 is the eligibility requirements, both in terms of eligible applicants. Eligible applicants remain state and local governments, transit agencies, port authorities, NPOs, other political subdivisions, and that includes groups of jurisdictions that may wish to apply together. Private entities are not eligible to be an applicant directly, but private entities can partner with public sector entities. State and local governments can apply in partnerships with private entities for private projects. In terms of eligible projects, two keys. One is we're looking at capital investments, and it should be in surface transportation infrastructure, which generally includes roads, highways, and bridges, public transportation projects, rail projects, both passenger and freight, and port investments in multimodal, intermodal projects that fit within that framework are also eligible. One thing to note, you may have a project that has transportation components which are tied in with other components, be they housing components or other development components. For purposes of Tiger, the transportation components of a much larger project are eligible. All of the expenses that are outside of the transportation components would not be eligible. In terms of award amounts, this slide really goes through some of the criteria which are set forth in the 2010 Appropriations Act for how much grant funds we can give to particular projects. Generally, the award size should be between $10 million at the low end and $200 million at the at the top. That's for the amount of Tiger grant funds requested and awarded. This time around, in the first round in Tiger 1, we did not have a requirement to for applicants to provide matching funds. This time around, there is a requirement to provide 20% or more of the project costs through a match, so we can no longer fund 100% of a project. That's outside of a rural area. This time around, we do have a $140 million amount, which is reserved for projects located in rural areas. And in rural areas, we're able to fund 100% of the project costs, and the minimum grant size drops down to a $1 million. So the rules are a little bit different for rural areas. We have a similar requirement to last time with a percentage of funds which can go to any projects in any one state. This time it's 25% of the funds maximum to any one state, or $150 million. In the last round, it was up to $300 million in any one state, but we did not reach that maximum in any state around the country. Here again, we have up to $150 million is available to be used to support TIFIA financing to pay for the subsidy and administrative costs. In the last round, we had up to $200 million. And as we discussed, we have this time around up to $35 million, which is available for planning grants. The selection criteria that we're using to evaluate projects and which we expect projects to align with in submitting applications is very, very similar to the selection criteria that were included in the first round of Tiger. We have two primary selection criteria, and then we'll have two secondary selection criteria. The primary selection criteria starts off with long-term outcomes. And these are really the five key long-term outcomes that we're looking for. They align with the Secretary's priorities, and they're ones that have not changed from the first round to the second round. The first one is state of good repair, which goes to the condition of infrastructure, and we want projects that are going to be improving the condition of infrastructure. Economic competitiveness, this one is really thinking about the medium to long-term economic competitiveness of the United States, boosting productivity. The third one is livability, which is really focusing on the quality of communities for people who are living and working there, and how infrastructure relates and can improve the quality of those communities. The fourth one is environmental sustainability. The primary focus of environmental sustainability is improving energy efficiency, reducing dependence on oil and greenhouse gas emissions, but also includes environmental impacts, reducing environmental impacts. And the final one is safety, improving the safety of U.S. transportation facilities. These are the key long-term outcomes we're looking for in the primary selection criteria. You have to make sure that your project hits these criteria well. Your project does not have to hit or align well with all of these, but it should align well with one or more of them. And in order to advance in the evaluation process, you do need to demonstrate that your project aligns well with at least one of these. Preferably, it aligns very well with one, or it aligns well with multiple of these long-term outcomes. The next of the primary selection criteria, and the reason we call these primary selection criteria and the other secondary selection criteria, is because the primary selection criteria are given more weight in the evaluation process. Going to the next slide, the next of the primary selection criteria is job creation and economic stimulus. And this we are no longer, the program is no longer under the Recovery Act, it's under the 2010 Appropriations Act, but we are still including job creation and economic stimulus as a primary selection criteria given where the current economy is. So this is still an important aspect of your project, is how quickly you can get started, create jobs, and stimulate rapid increases in economic activity. That's still an important aspect of the application. The two secondary selection criteria are innovation and partnership. And innovation really refers to whether or not you have any innovative strategies incorporated in the project that help you achieve the long-term outcomes. And partnership goes to two things. One is collaboration amongst a variety of partners in the project. That could be state, federal, local, a variety of public and private entities who can be participating in the planning and delivery of the project, and also contributing financial resources to the project. And the second part of partnership is integration of transportation priorities with other public service efforts. If there's other public entities which are interested in the project for other reasons and pursuing other outcomes, and the project integrates transportation goals with those other goals, that's certainly a positive aspect of an application. I'll turn it over to Darren Timothy, who will talk about benefit cost analysis. Benefit cost analysis is not one of the selection criteria, but it's an important component of any application.
Yeah. As in the First Tiger program, the department is requesting the applicants provide a benefit cost analysis. And includes a statement that the department won't provide funding to any project that it definitively concludes doesn't have projected benefits that exceed the cost of the project. There is in the notice of funding availability a more detailed guidance on doing these benefit cost analyses, and the bullet points listed here is essentially some of the topics that are covered there. It's in fact, roughly one third of the NOFA is this Appendix A that goes through the guidance on doing benefit cost analysis. All the benefit cost analyses provided for projects are reviewed by a team of economists from different modes in the Office of the Secretary here at DOT. And we assign ratings to those projects based on the quality of the analysis and how useful the analysis is in helping us reach a determinant as to whether the project's benefits exceed its costs or not. There's an important discussion there about the difference between benefit cost analysis and economic impact analysis. Will be both useful approaches, pretty useful information. What we really want to focus on those elements that would be included in BCA and not those in economic impact analysis. The guidance discusses the importance of having a useful baseline and project alternatives, such things as identifying for a large project, making sure that you include analyses of lesser alternatives rather than simply having a do everything versus a do nothing case. There's guidance on the application of discounting, which is always an important part of any forward-looking analysis, such as a benefit cost analysis. Guidance on the importance of providing information about the forecasting methods used, and on recognizing that projects are expected to have evolve over time, and that it's not appropriate to simply use an end year analysis and apply those benefits to the entire analysis period. The guidance goes through types of benefits. We are asking project sponsors to quantify the benefits in each of the five long-term outcome categories. What's less important there, however, is not so much which category a particular private benefit is in, but that it's counted once and only once. This type of approach is what we in the Tiger One, we actually had different tiers of what type of analysis was expected on the part of applicants, so it required a full benefit cost analysis for very large projects. We consider lesser analysis. This time around, we're not making that type of distinction. All projects are being asked to provide analysis with the understanding that smaller projects are expected to have less of a detailed analysis and perhaps more of a qualitative discussion as opposed to quantitative. It's also important to make sure that the cost of the project matched the project that the benefits are being estimated for, and to the extent possible, providing us with transparency and reproducibility. Basically, this is an exhortation to show us your work so that it's very helpful. The more you can show us, the better sense we have of what the project is all about, and a better opportunity we have to make the determination that we're asked to do.
All right, so in the next two slides, we talk about the pre-application and the application process. This is, I'll note, it's different from the first round of Tiger, where we only collected an application and we did not receive pre-applications. This time around, we are asking applicants to provide a pre-application. The due date for the pre-application is July 16th, 2010. And the pre-application is not for purposes of engaging in an iterative process with each applicant to sort of work on the applications. It's really more from our perspective of getting a sense of the universe of applications that are going to be coming in, so we can prepare for the evaluation process. And also, there are a few aspects of the pre-application which we are interested in. We're considering a sort of threshold requirements. We do want to make sure that projects are eligible projects and eligible applicants. We want to make sure that the projects have lined up the 20% match that's required for projects that are not located in rural areas. We also want to make sure that projects have begun to tackle and are substantially complete with the NEPA process, and that really goes to project readiness. This is one area where we've made a few changes in the final notice of funding availability from the interim notice of funding availability, with respect to what we expect to see from different applicants on NEPA. Generally speaking, we'd like to see applications that can say NEPA is complete. We recognize that not all of the applications are going to be able to say that. And in some cases, we're okay with NEPA being substantially complete, and we have a reasonable confidence that there's a timeline that works and that can get us to a completion of NEPA. This is important because we do have a statutory obligation date. We have to obligate all funds by September 30th, 2012, and we need to know that NEPA will be complete well in advance of that. We also recognize that there are some projects which have not previously anticipated federal funds, and they don't have any other traditional federal programs that they can turn to for funds. So it was never in sort of the picture to do NEPA. In those cases, we still expect the projects to have done analysis of the environmental impacts and to have thought about that, although we do, and this is spelled out a little bit more in the current notice, the final notice, we do we don't expect those projects to be substantially complete with NEPA, given the types of funding that have been available to them outside of the Tiger program. The application is due on August 23rd, 2010. The application is similar to the applications we had under Tiger 1. They're a 25-page limit. We did, this time around, I wanted to provide in the notice of funding availability a little bit more of an outline we strongly suggest that applications follow that outline. It's a good way to get across the key items of information that are needed for us to evaluate the project. So that outline is included in the final notice. I would encourage applicants to take a look at that and try their best to conform with that outline. While there is a 25-page limit, there are certain items like the benefit cost analysis, which we recognize that in some cases that could easily get to be longer than 25 pages. In that case, what we would like is for the summary, the highlights of the benefit cost analysis, or for example, the NEPA documentation to be included in the 25-page narrative. And the more the robust benefit cost analysis or a link to the NEPA documentation, these types of things would not be counted towards the 25-page limit. And with that, we'll jump to Tiger 2 TIFIA payments and Dwayne Callender. We'll talk about that.
Okay, similar to Tiger 1, $150 million was made available for the subsidy costs and administrative expenses for TIFIA. TIFIA is currently oversubscribed, so it's outside of the regular process. This is one of the only avenues to get TIFIA funding for loans, lines of credit, or loan guarantees. Any money from that $150 million, as I said, will be used to cover the government's expected cost for each credit assistance that we make available. The DOT may offer grant applicants a TIFIA payment even if they haven't applied for it, similar to the Tiger TIFIA Challenge grants that were made in the first go-around. The current process would have applicants submitting a Tiger 2 discretionary grant application and at the same time a TIFIA letter of interest, so that the first time around we actually had applications come in at that point, but because the projects have to go through the Tiger process, it doesn't make sense to have borrowers expend the resources to create the application if they're not going to be successful for Tiger. So the letter of interest will be our indication of what the potential pipeline might be. And then if an applicant is selected, then they would have to comply with all of the TIFIA program requirements, like the application, the full-blown application, the $50,000 application fee, and they'll go through our regular due diligence on the project. Applicants may also apply for both a grant and a TIFIA payment on the same project, and there's not any prohibition or any discouragement of that, I guess, at this point. So.
All right. The next piece of this is the actual evaluation process. At the DOT, when we get all these applications in, we have multimodal teams of technical and professional staff from throughout the department who review these applications, including on each team for, representatives from the Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Transit Administration, the Maritime Administration, and the Railroad Administration, and also including members from the Office of the Secretary. They evaluate the applications and give them ratings for the selection criteria. The ratings are highly recommended, recommended, not recommended, or negative. And that is really how well the project aligns with the selection criteria is what determines whether or not the applications will be advanced to a senior level review team. We also have an economic analysis team, which contributes evaluations of the benefit cost analyses that are provided by the projects. And we have an environmental team, which looks at the project readiness and NEPA and helps figure out how ready the projects are to move forward quickly. And that leads to selection of the projects and project administration and reporting. This is what we're moving through in the first round of Tiger. Now, this is the next slide. We're covering for each of the Tiger projects that were selected. We have one of those four relevant modal administrations which administers the grant and enters into a grant agreement with the grant recipient and the relevant modal administration. And we expect that the process for Tiger 2 will be similar. It's important to note, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a requirement to obligate all funds by September 30th, 2012. We are going to be looking to announce the project awards and enter into grant agreements as quickly as possible so that we can be sure to hit this date for obligating all of the funds. The next component of this presentation is strategies for competitive applications. And we did have, a week or two ago, we had a seminar here in Washington, D.C., which was also broadcast on the web, where we went through these key elements that, based on sort of the collective experience within the department for Tiger 1, we wanted to highlight these aspects of competitive applications, which we think are very useful and important for applicants to know. So we're going to run through these now, and I'll turn it over to Deputy Assistant Secretary Beth Osborne to get us started on that.
Okay, the first item on this list is eligibility, and we've run through many of the eligibility requirements that are in statute and were listed in the Notice of Funding Availability. I'll just gloss over them again. It must be a capital investment in a surface transportation project, and that project must be one of independent utility. The applicant must be a government entity. There's a statutory minimum of $10 million per project. However, it's a lower minimum for rural projects of $1 million and a maximum of $200 million per application and $150 million per single state. Now, the point we really want to make here is eligibility is not the same thing as being competitive. You can meet the minimum eligibility requirements and not have a competitive application. And this is something that is different than a lot of other transportation programs, which tend to be very formula-based. You look at whether or not you're meeting the statutory criteria, and then you have great flexibility. In this program, because it is so oversubscribed, we do have the opportunity to choose from applications that go well beyond basic eligibility, and therefore you should think more than just meeting minimum eligibility, but in terms of being highly competitive. The second area is the criteria. A lot of folks have come in and asked us about how we evaluate these projects. And the overwhelming focus of our evaluation is on the long-term criteria, the five elements that that Jake laid out: economic competitiveness, state of good repair, livability, environmental sustainability, and safety. Now, I think the safety one is the one where there was the least confusion. It's an area that within transportation we have quantified for years, and therefore it's something that people were very comfortable with. In the other areas, I'd like to get into a little more detail of each of them. One is economic competitiveness. Within economic competitiveness, there are two things to be conscious of. One is when we're looking at creating greater economic competitiveness and economic activity, we are looking at an overall increase to the country. In other words, we're not looking at a program that will move jobs from one state to another. So you may, for example, have a port improvement project that will result in increased freight movement through that port and through your area. However, it is clear that it will move it from another neighboring port. That is not overall increase in job, it's just movement within the country, and we are focusing on those projects that overall increase economic activity and increase jobs. The other thing within economic competitiveness is while we are looking at the region, a more competitive application will be one that considers not just the regional economic health, but what happens to the community touched by the project. Sometimes there will be winners and losers with transportation projects where the neighborhood touched is harmed by the project even though the region is helped. In a highly competitive program like this, we can afford to choose those that have been very sensitive and therefore are not, there are no losers to the project. It is context sensitive, and thinking about the community is touching while helping the economics overall. In terms of state of good repair, sometimes we would see applications in communities that, you know, might make a choice, for example, to do things that cause a transportation project to degrade faster than it would otherwise, maybe by permitting heavier trucks to run over that roadway and getting the economic benefit of having those heavier trucks. But that is not going to be as competitive an application to say that you've done something voluntarily that degraded your roadway and now you're looking for help to fix it as a community that is truly struggling to get their system up to a state of good repair. So I would be conscious of those sorts of issues as well. In terms of livability, we lay out four things we're looking at in terms of livability. One is transportation options. Two is particularly transportation options for non-motorized communities such as seniors, disabled, and those sort and low-income members of the community. Three is intermodal connectedness. And four is coordinating transportation and land use decisions. So we've got some very specific things we're looking at in terms of livability and what we mean there, and I would focus in on those four prongs. Five is environmental sustainability, and that is a broad area which can mean reduction of oil usage or greenhouse gas emissions, but it also can mean reduction of stormwater runoff and pollution caused by that. What I would say within environmental sustainability is this is the long-term criteria section. So something that is bottleneck relief in that it will reduce a bottleneck for the medium term or the short term is not going to rate as well as one that has a very long-term horizon that can reduce oil use and greenhouse gas emission over a 50 or 100-year time frame as opposed to just a 10 or 20-year time frame. So I would say please be very careful in your focus on that. That is the crux of the application. If you're not performing well there, we're not going to look beyond that. As Jake said, you don't have to do very well in all of the criteria. If you look through our Tiger grantees in the first round, you will notice projects that perform very well under certain areas. For example, in New Mexico, US 491 performed very highly on the safety rating. It was a roadway that had three times the fatalities of the state, and this one project is going to result in bringing it below the state average. There are other projects like in Milwaukee, a lift bridges project, which is really a state of good repair project, Crescent Corridor, which is an economic competitiveness and sustainability project, New Orleans Streetcar, which is primarily about livability. So, you know, you can look through those projects and see that we were not looking for something that performed fabulously on all five. We were really looking for those that really stood out in one or two or maybe three. The third category is clarity of application and project description. This goes back to what we were talking about, this program being oversubscribed. We got 1,400 applications worth over $60 billion for $1.5 billion in funding availability. Therefore, this application process is very much like you would expect an application to the most highly competitive colleges in the country. And maybe, you know, in helping your kids prepare those college applications, or remembering yourself, you're looking to really stand out in an area where the folks reviewing it are reviewing fantastic amounts of applications and have their pick. And therefore, the clarity of your application is paramount. You may have all the information in there, but if it's hard to read or it's hard to find, it's as if it does not exist. Think about a reviewer that's going to be reading 150 applications in a 2-week period of time, or maybe a 3 or 4 week period of time. Even still, 150 applications is an exorbitant amount of reading. So to the extent you can stick with the proposed outline of applications so that they are looking at a similar flow, that you're writing something that is very clear in terms of the project description and what the federal dollars will be used for, so that it is obvious from the very beginning of the application. Sometimes it was extremely difficult to ferret that out. And something that could be read by your neighbor that's never worked in transportation and they'll still understand what your goal of this project is. That is going to be much more likely to do well, just because the people who have the overwhelming load are going to have a sense of what they're dealing with as they are culling through an enormous amount of applications.
All right, the next one of the strategies here is size of grant request. And I want to preface by saying we don't have a particular size of grant request that we think is the right size for the grant request. Having said that, the last round of applications, the average grant size, projects were allowed to be up to $300 million, and the average grant size was closer to $30 million. We had a few projects in the $100 million range, and those were often multi-state, multi-jurisdictional projects where there was a number of partners who were receiving funds. The reason we want to talk about this is because we have in Tiger 2, similar to Tiger 1, sort of a requirement to balance, on the one hand, our desire to really do some major projects, nationally significant type projects that are very expensive, and we have to put a lot of money into them, with our desire to fund projects, to provide equitable geographic distribution, to fund projects which are important for local areas, for regions, for metropolitan areas. And this is a statutory requirement for us to take into account equitable geographic distribution, balancing the needs of urban and rural areas, and also providing a balance across the different modes that we have. So we have only $600 million this time, which is significantly less than the $1.5 billion which we had in the first round. And one way to think about this is to imagine if we were to split the country up into four regions and fund two projects in each region, which is not a lot considering the size of what those regions would look like. We'd already be at eight projects and down to, I think, around $70 million per project. If we were to fund four projects in each of the four regions, we'd be down to an average of about $35 million per project. So the reason we mention this is we want you to be very aware of the balancing that's required and the constraints that we're under in terms of funding projects which are looking for the full $200 million, which is available for each project. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about the projects that you're going to submit. And also keep that in mind when you're thinking about this next bullet point, leverages investment. And this goes back to a statutory requirement where we're supposed to give priority to projects which use Tiger funds to complete an overall financing package. We're looking for projects that have state, local, private sector funds in the project as well. I want to make sure to note in the notice of funding availability, we clarified what we mean by local match, which will get you to the 20% requirement. We can only fund up to 80% of the project, so we further defined what that 20% has to be. I would encourage you to look at that in the NOFA, but basically, outside of federal funds, any state, local, or other public funds combined with private sector funds can all be used for the 20% matching requirement. One other thing we note is that we're looking for funds that are going to be expended. We're not looking for people to include funds that have been expended previously in the past. So review that to make sure you have the requirements right for which funds are eligible for the match. But a critical point here, and this goes back to the fact that this is in the first round, at least, was a super competitive program. We expect it to be just as competitive this time. There's a difference between eligibility, what you have to put into the project in terms of 20%, and making your project as competitive as you might be able to. The more you can put into the project in terms of state, local, or private sector funds, or whatever types of funds you can put in, the better. And this really gets to the heart of what we think are some of the real benefits of a competitive grant program. We have an opportunity to really reward people who can get a lot of partners on board, can go through a sort of a well-coordinated and structured planning and delivery process where they're able to draw on a number of different resources. And our experience is that we've gotten a lot of really good applications from this competitive grant program and other competitive grant programs in terms of what we can encourage people to bring together in the application. So think about competitiveness in that section.
I would add one thing to what Jake said, which is while rural areas are not held to the 20% match requirement, in the first round of Tiger, we found many rural communities that were able to leverage a great deal of investment. So I would not necessarily look again at the eligibility requirements in terms of being competitive. We found struggling communities willing to put up a large amount of money to support a high priority project. And we found communities that weren't struggling very much, not willing to put up a great amount of investment for a project that they claimed was a priority. So again, in terms of looking at creating as competitive an application as possible, if you are asking how you can skate into the minimum eligible match, you're probably not creating the most competitive application possible.
The next bullet point is something we call project segmentation. And there's really two things I want to cover here. One is the point that Beth mentioned earlier about independent utility, which is we can only fund projects that have independent utility. And what we mean by that, and there is a term that's used in other contexts as well, including the NEPA context, but for purposes of evaluating applications, what we mean by independent utility is that, one, the project will provide transportation benefits when complete. And those benefits should be the benefits that are described when you're talking about the long-term outcomes and the other criteria that we're looking for. And two, that the project, when complete, will be an operable segment that can be used. So we're looking for projects that, when they're built, when all of the Tiger funds and all of the other committed funds are spent and the project is done, absent sort of additional investment, the project is ready to go and will provide benefits. So for example, if you have a project that you've split into multiple phases and you're looking for Tiger to help you finish phase one, from the department's perspective, we would want to see phase one as a complete transportation project, even if there are additional phases coming down the line which will add to the project, enhance the project, improve the project, and sort of build out on the project. We need this project that we're building to be a complete project when all the funds have been expended. If the project is in a situation where you'll complete phase one and you'll have to find additional funds to finish phase two before the project can actually be used, then in that situation the project would not have independent utility and we would not want to commit federal funds to what is in essence sort of half a project with the expectation or the promise or the thought that more funds would be committed at a later stage to finish the operable segment. The other thing that I think is worth noting here goes back to clarity. And this is, if you have a project which does have multiple components that have independent utility, I think it's very important for your application to reflect the different components of the project, why each one has independent utility, what the benefits of each of those components are. And this is especially useful if we would get an application for the maximum amount of funds and we like aspects of the application. There's other aspects of the application that may not be as compelling. It's in your benefit to provide a very convincing case to the people reviewing the application that they can get a lot of the benefits of the project if they choose one component of the project, not all of the project as a whole. So as you're putting together your applications, think about providing in a very clear way where those projects can be segmented, what the different packages of projects in there are. And it may be that the project is one project and you need to do the whole thing to complete it, and that's fine as well. You don't have to break it up into segments if it's one project, but to the extent you are able to, that's certainly a worthwhile and helpful for the people reviewing the application.
On benefit cost analysis, I think the key thing to take away is that the benefit cost analysis is really complementary to the description, narrative that addresses the long-term outcomes and the other evaluation criteria. Every time I've seen what I would consider a good benefit cost analysis, it reflects a project sponsor who's thought carefully about the project and really understands what they're trying to achieve and has gone through the steps to document that. Conversely, projects that I think that answer is a bit fuzzier tend to come up with lower quality analyses. It's also important to have the level of analysis be commensurate with the focus of the project. And so a project that's expected to have significant safety benefits, and where that's kind of the primary purpose and need of the project, would be expected to have a more careful, more detailed analysis of safety benefits, as opposed to a project where safety is kind of a more ancillary outcome for that specific project. And so on, going through the analysis, following the guidance that we have, will also get you much further to where you want to be.
I'd like to add two things to that. One is that that DOT will not rank a project based on its benefit cost analysis. This is supportive information. This is the data backing up the long-term criteria, but it is not going to be the basis for a ranking. The second is that I've heard a lot of concerns from communities that don't necessarily have the larger departments or capacity that this could be difficult in terms of paying some outsider or consultant to do your benefit cost analysis. In terms of the first round of Tiger, we saw very impressive benefit cost analyses done by smaller organizations and in-house. It is not something that we want folks to believe that they have to go out and spend a lot of money to accomplish. It's just something that requires you to develop and to document the data to support the claims that you're making in terms of your long-term criteria.
Yeah. And really, the raw material for a benefit cost analysis ought to be contained in the planning documents that are produced in developing the project. And it's just finding that and presenting that information that's important.
Great. The next point is something that we've touched on earlier, project readiness and NEPA. And I think the key, one of the keys here is this is no longer a Recovery Act program. So some of the Recovery Act deadlines don't apply. We no longer have to give priority to projects that can be completed within 3 years, which was something we had to consider in the first round. However, we do still have as a primary selection criteria that the project can create jobs and business activity quickly. And that's still something that we're going to look at. And we also still have a requirement that we obligate all the funds, in this case it's by September 30th, 2012, which is not that far off. So we are paying very much attention to project readiness. We have six elements of that which are outlined in the Notice of Funding Availability, which includes any necessary legislative approvals, environmental approvals, financial feasibility, technical feasibility. But it's important that you, in your application, give the department the sense and the comfort that the project can get started quickly and will obligate all of the funds by September 30th, 2012. As mentioned earlier, we have provided some more guidance on what we're looking for in terms of NEPA in the final notice, and I would encourage you to look at that. As mentioned earlier.
Now, in terms of projects that stand out, I'm going to talk about some projects that really shone in the first round, but also some projects that that typically did not perform terribly well. And before I get into this, I do want to say that this is not to say that any projects were that the ones that stood out are necessarily the best investment of dollars. It's just that in this competitive process, they rose to the top for various reasons. So one thing that tended to rise to the top were non-traditional projects or projects that came with all the long-term outcomes, but wouldn't have any place else to go for federal dollars. And you'll notice some of those in the first round of funding, like the Crescent Corridor, some of our port projects, things like that. Also, projects that created new partnerships, multi-state projects, public-private partnerships, things that are very difficult to organize and also tend to be difficult to fund through our current program, which is focused on state by state. Some examples of that would include the Woodward Avenue Rail in terms of a public-private partnership or National Gateway or CREATE. In terms of breaking down modal silos and government silos, both silos internal to DOT and between DOT and other federal agencies, or between federal agencies and state and local agencies, really rose to the top. One example is the Portland Innovation Quadrant, which we struggled to even define because it had a roadway component and a streetcar component and a bike ped component. And that was a really interesting project because you couldn't even type it as one particular mode. Another area is one that supports other key national priorities. So, for example, a project that supports the manufacturing and movement of wind energy components and another non-transportation but still national key priority. And the last part is strong local state or private funding support. Now, in terms of projects that did not tend to compete as well, again, I'm not saying that we don't value these projects. What we're saying is, in terms of an overly subscribed, very competitive program, these did not do as well as other types of investments did. And examples of those tended to be roadway resurfacing projects, parking lots, research without deployment. And by deployment, we're not just talking about a demonstration program, but true widespread deployment. Cruise ship terminals, museum improvements, and as I mentioned earlier, economic development projects that displace economic development in other areas.
Great, so I think the last piece of this is the timeline of where we are. We published the criteria on April 26, 2010. Federal Register today includes the final notice, which was available on Friday's Federal Register for public inspection. The pre-applications must be submitted by July 16th this summer, and the applications must be submitted by August 23rd. We have a statutory requirement that we announce the project selected for funding no earlier then September 15th, 2010. Our goal and our efforts are going to be try to announce awards as soon thereafter as we can. We don't have a definite date for when we will announce the awards, but we will. Our hope and our goals are going to be to do that as soon as we can, considering the number of applications that come in. Which, as we mentioned earlier, in the last round for Tiger One, we had over 1,400 applications, so it will take us a couple of days to get through the applications.
All right, Jennifer.
Okay.